James Krychik, I should say, Jamie to his friends. Thank you for participating in this, which I think must be the seventh or eighth event we have done in connection to essays we are publishing in the journal Sapir. It is published by the Maimonides Fund, subtitled A Journal of Jewish Conversations. I edit it along with my wonderful colleague, Felicia Herman, and our friends at the Maimonides Fund, above all, Ariella Saperstein. We are now in the process of finalizing the third issue of Sapir, which is going to be on the subject of continuity. The first issue, which I hold here in my hands, and I think it's already turning into something of a collector's item because it's such a elegant, beautiful looking product, was on the subject of social justice, which is the one in which your essay, Our Duty to Be Unimpressed, appears. The second issue on power, third on continuity, and the fourth is going to be on the subject of aspiration, Jewish aspiration. And one of the purposes of Sapir is to be faithful to that subtitle of ours, A Journal of Jewish Conversation. We have gone out of our way to reach out to writers and thinkers from across the ideological and religious spectrum, Israelis, Americans, Europeans, to really capture a kind of breadth of sophisticated thinking about the future and the well-being of the Jewish community and the topics that really need to engage us as Jews. And your essay, again, from our first issue, our spring issue, Our Duty to Be Unimpressed, people who haven't read it can find it at sapirjournal.org. Just make sure to look for the first edition, not the second. Your essay really is on, I think, maybe the most important subject, I think, that confronts the Jewish community today, which is the widening and increasingly visible rift between the political left, or at least parts of the political left, and the Jewish community from worldwide, but particularly in the United States and in Great Britain, which is subject to which you devote a lot of your essay. And it's important because many American Jews, actually 75% of American Jews, sort of see themselves as people who are at least slightly to the left, as members of the Democratic Party. Many of us have had relatives, close friends, who are not just on the Democratic Party left, the center left, but on the far left. And I think it's becoming increasingly clear that parts of the far left, maybe you would even say a lot of the far left, is shot through with a new kind of anti-Semitism. Maybe I'm wrong in saying it's a new kind of anti-Semitism. So with that as a kind of a preamble, I'd like to turn it over to you, Jamie, to describe what you see as the characteristics of the new stash or the new slash old anti-Semitism of the left and how it is that we should recognize it, think about it, and maybe as we move forward, fight it.
Well, thanks to you, Brett, and thanks to the Maimonides Fund for hosting this. I've been very impressed with Sapir. I think it's really difficult to say new things about these sorts of topics because there's so many Jewish publications or Jewish themed publications and venues. And I write for some of them and Brett writes for some of them. And so to come out with something that is actually saying things that are novel and challenging, I think is a difficult task. And this publication has really done that. And I'm honored to be asked to be a part of it. I think the problem is bigger than just the political left. I think it's liberal institutions in general. Mm-hmm. It's not just politics. It's the universities. It's the nonprofit world, the foundations. It's culture. And in fact, there's a great essay in the current issue. I think that you interviewed Fane Rosenbaum, who has a whole article about sort of the decline in Jewish influence in American culture. But culture is a part of this. It's Hollywood. It's public education. It's basically all these institutions that Jews, American Jews, you know, either built in the case of Hollywood or enriched to such a tremendous degree. If you look at, you know, higher education, didn't really become the kind of envy of the world that it did until the quotas were lifted, right, in the 1950s and 60s. And I think all these institutions are now becoming more uncomfortable for Jews. And so it's not just the Democratic Party or the political sphere. It's really just sort of liberal America, and small L liberal, not necessarily politically liberal, although most of these places are politically liberal. And I think what's challenging about it and what distinguishes it from right-wing anti-Semitism is that this variety is adamant in stating that it's not anti-Semitic. I mean, the right-wing anti-Semite is very open about it. They're quite proud about it. They're quite vulgar. There really isn't any beating around the bush. It's very much at the center of their belief. And it because they are openly supremacists, right? They're white supremacists or they're Nordic supremacists or whatever their ideology is. They're very explicit about being better than other people. And Jews are obviously a target for that hatred, along with all the other races that aren't races and religions and whatnot, who aren't part of that exclusive group. The problem is when you're dealing with this kind of left-wing anti-Semitism is that it is, not only does it deny that what they're saying is anti-Semitic, they get extremely peeved at being accused of this. And they then accuse the Jews who are pointing this out of basically being special pleaders and, you know, inventing this problem where it doesn't exist and trying to further their own agenda. And I think we saw this, you mentioned the British case. I mean, this was very clear there where you had a man who was quite clearly an anti-Semite in Jeremy Corbyn. And, you know, I don't think I need to list all the reasons why. I think if you're on this Zoom chat, you're probably familiar enough to know what this man's record was. And you had many people in that country and in the Labour Party in particular who just refused to acknowledge this. And these are people who, you know, would be the first to complain about any other form of bigotry, whether it's anti-Black racism or homophobia or Islamophobia, you name it. I mean, they would have no compunction whatsoever. Go ahead.
What's always extraordinary about that is that not only would they deny that Corbyn is an anti-Semite, but they would claim that it was a conspiracy of media and right-wing American Jews and Likudniks in Israel who were ginning up a campaign through an effectively conspiratorial mechanism to slander and stain the good name of the leader of Her Majesty's opposition.
Right. And so because anti-Semitism is sort of the conspiracy, I mean, it's really like the oldest conspiracy ever is the anti-Semitic conspiracy. They all kind of derive from the Protocols of the Elders of Zion or going back further, right? And so when Jews or even non-Jews would complain about Corbyn, they are then, you know, accused of being a part of this movement, this kind of conspiratorial movement to undermine him. And it's similar in the United States too. I mean, when Ilhan Omar made pretty blatantly anti-Semitic remarks and she's criticized for it, the reaction to it is conspiratorial, and it sees a conspiracy out to undermine this, you know, poor young woman of color. And, you know, I think over the past 2 years, what's been very difficult for American Jews, you know, I think of moments that were sort of, you know, very troubling. And when I really sort of questioned my status as a Jew in this country or the future of American Jewry, something I never really had to do until recently. And one was when the Democratic Party was unable to censure her, despite, you know, Nancy Pelosi criticizing her, but basically Nancy Pelosi revealing that she didn't have the votes within her own caucus to censure this woman. And then a couple of months ago, I think in May, was it, after the latest violence between Gaza and between Hamas and Israel in the Gaza Strip, we saw basically European style, you know, street level anti-Semitism. Basically, you know, gangs of marauding Arabs in cars driving through the streets of West Hollywood and the Diamond District in New York City and just attacking Jews in broad daylight. I mean, that is not something that I recall ever really happening in this country. I mean, maybe since like Leo Frank, you know, which was why the ADL was founded. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that you read about all the time in Europe. Whenever there's violence in the Middle East, there is...
There was more than that. I mean, I would just sort of further to your point. I mean, to me, what was so distressing about those incidents in West Hollywood and in New York wasn't simply that they happened, but when they did happen, getting leaders of major institutions to condemn them in language that didn't end up devolving into a kind of version of All Lives Matter.
Yes.
Became very difficult. And I think it was the chancellor of Rutgers University who put out a mealy-mouthed statement, if ever there was one, condemning anti-Semitism. And then, of course, every other bigotry or ism or phobia that one could mention. And then being hounded to effectively apologize for attacking for criticizing anti-Semitism. So it wasn't, these same institutions didn't even have the courage to offer a vanilla statement of condemnation for anti-Semitism.
I mean, and I would say, of course, yeah, and this was, and this was after an event. If there were these Atlanta shootings of these massage parlors where some Asian women were killed because they happened to be working in a massage parlor. There was no evidence whatsoever, and the killer, I believe, has either confessed or been arraigned or whatnot. There is no evidence, and there was no evidence that this had anything to do with the race of these women. And yet, instantly, before the bodies were, while the bodies were still warm, this was being hyped and promoted by all the nation's major media, by leading cultural influencers and figures, as being an anti-Asian hate crime. And it had nothing to do with race, nothing.
So let's then get to the sort of nub of this. And by the way, I should say to those of you listening in, there is a chat function, there is a Q&A function. And as we move forward, I would urge you to start putting questions as they occur to our audience in either the chat or the Q&A function. And later on in our conversation, I will turn to some of those questions, make them hard, that they don't have to be softballs. I think Jamie's ready for it. But I want to sort of get a little more, you know, get at this a little more deeply, because it is striking the extent to which there has been a kind of a collapse of institutional nerve and clarity, specifically on the question of the Jews. And, you know, one can imagine living in a very different world where people just don't get upset about hate crimes in general, right? At least unless they don't result in death or anything of the kind. But what was so unnerving here was that the standard that might apply to bigotries directed at other people, right? That standard didn't apply to Jews. So in the world of inclusion, Jews were not included, you know, according to
the standard. Well, it matters who the perpetrator is, right? Because we saw when there was Pittsburgh, when there was it's hard to describe the killer as being part of a political movement, but he was clearly a kind of extreme right or reactionary racist type of killer who was anti-immigration. And he saw Jews as, I mean, this is according to his manifesto, he blamed the Jews, or as he referred to it as a kike infestation. He blamed them for welcoming refugees to the United States, right? And so that's a horrific case of anti-Semitism, murderous anti-Semitism, the worst on American soil. That was universally condemned because the perpetrator fit into the expected comfortable box that the left is happy to condemn. When it is, you know, when it is, you know, Arab men on the streets of New York or Los Angeles, it becomes more complicated. It shouldn't be more complicated, but it becomes more complicated if you see the world in this sort of intersectional matrix of oppression, where there are basically a pyramid, right, of the oppressed. And whereas Jews were higher on that pyramid, say after World War II, they're no longer really considered victims. And you see this in all different, extremely minute and specific ways. I mean, you know, I write a lot about gay issues in the gay community, and the way in which, you know, gay white men have become a target in just the past couple of years for opprobrium within the LGBT community. I mean, I'm not, these are not right-wing homophobes who use this language. It is within the community, the way in which gay white men have now been demonized and villainized just in the past several years, I think is, they've become almost sort of the Jews of the kind of gay community. And I see this happening in all different sorts of communities, you know, where it's how many intersectional points do you have? And, you know, Jews just aren't, Jews are white now. Jews are considered white, and which would come as news to, you know, lots of Jews, obviously, who come from the Sephardic world or the Mizrahi Jews who never thought of themselves that way.
Or from the Ashkenazi Jews.
Who were not considered white when they came to this country.
Were not considered white by the Aryans who tried to exterminate them.
And we're not considered by, and I would also say Jews aren't considered by, are not considered white by the people for whom being white is really, really, really important. They don't consider us white. So this is something that's happening across the society. It's not just in the Jewish community. It's not just Jews who are the target of this. Where there's kind of a Balkanization of our society, and we're all being put into places on a pyramid, and that kind of determines your virtue, if you will. It's a pyramid of virtue. So that's kind of a long-winded answer to the question.
You know, one of the points that you make in your piece, which is I think it's so profound. I mean, it's really that it's the headline of your piece, mm-hmm. The duty to be unimpressed. And you refer to Ben Hecht and the Guide to the Bedeviled. Talk to us a little bit about Hecht and his sense of the mission of the Jews and why it has been so both extraordinary as well as, I guess the word would be problematic in terms of Jewish life.
Ben Hecht, I think is safe to say, was one of the great Jews, even though he was completely secular, didn't really think much of religion at all, came from a very kind of poor background. He was a journalist in the early 20th century, real kind of scrappy guy, worked as a newspaper reporter in Chicago and wrote about, you know, drug malls and saloons and prohibition and real kind of, you know, salt of the earth. He wrote the play, The Front Page, which became a film. And he was really one of the great early golden Hollywood screenwriters. And he wrote this book called The Guide to the Bedeviled, which I've had on my bookshelf and had been meaning to read for a long time. A rabbi who's a friend of mine gave it.
Somewhere here too. It's probably within reach. It's a wonderful book.
A rabbi gave it to me and said, you have to read this book. And honestly, being assigned this essay was the excuse I had to read it. And it's a fascinating book, and I recommend it to everyone. But he had this insight, which I hadn't really thought of before. And he wrote this book in 1940, early 40s, maybe 43, 44. Yeah. So it was in the midst of the Holocaust, and he's very angry. And he, by his own experience, has said, I had never experienced anti-Semitism in America. But now I'm seeing it from abroad, and it led him to try to find out why a whole nation could be driven to this sort of eliminationist hatred. And he says it goes back to basically the fact that the Jews are the first people who are basically the cause of realizing men as individuals. But this is thousands of years before the Enlightenment. I mean, this is basically understanding that there is a God to which men are held accountable. They're not held accountable to kings or priests or dictators or commissars or any other man. They are accountable to this God. I mean, Jews are the creators of monotheism. Not the creators, they are the first monotheistic people. And that is such a profound development in human history, because up until that point, you know, people weren't individuals. They were the property of whichever nobleman or a king or, you know, ruler whose land they happened to belong, you know, who they happened to till their crops on, right? And so here come the Jews, and the Jews have this profound insight, which is, no, we are not accountable to you. We are accountable to the Lord. And even, you know, so even when you're dealing with, say, you know, communists who don't believe in God, they're atheists. The fact that you have
ostensibly atheists,
they are religious in their own way. Yes, they have their own religious dogmas. But even people who are ostensibly atheists, to have these, you know, these stubborn people who have their own book, they have their own values that go back thousands of years, they have their own way of life, they have their own dietary restrictions, they have their own life cycle commitments and ceremonies and whatnot. If you are a totalizing political leader, or if you believe in a totalizing political ideology, then these people are a supreme threat to you because they have their own way of doing things. And this is why I think liberal democracy is so important for Jews and pluralism is so important for Jews, and why Jews have never thrived more than in liberal pluralistic societies, is because a liberal pluralistic society, if it really believes in its liberalism and its pluralism, will make room for Jews to live their lives and have their traditions, just like it makes room for Catholics to have their parochial schools, and it makes room for Muslims to pray five times a day. Right? And so that's why Jews thrive under liberal democracy. But if you're dealing with people who have their own totalizing political ideology or social ideology that will admit, or brook no criticism, and everyone has to follow it, then the Jews, I think, are the worst enemy you have, because they are the oldest enemy you have, because they're the ones who are responsible for this notion that all of us are individual, and all of human life is sacred because it is created in the image of the Lord. And that is really, really annoying and obnoxious to whether you're
also
a Hitler.
I agree, and I would sort of caveat and maybe expand that, which is it's not simply that Jews are ultimately accountable to the Lord you know, they have a different set of commitments. I mean, you could argue that something similar also applies to Christians, right? And the render unto Caesar what is Caesar's formulation. But there are Jews reject the idea of the possibility of the perfectibility of mankind. And that, it seems to me, is a profound threat to any ideology, particularly ideologies on the left that believe that there's something inherently plastic and malleable in human nature, that all human relations are essentially a product of structural structures in society that can be reshaped the way you reshape Lego blocks as a child, or anything else that can be moved. And so that belief that humanity will never be able to simply fit into the boxes that ideologues shape for it is deeply problematic for millenarians of any kind, but particularly in our in the last century, profoundly problematic for millenarians of the left. Does that sound about?
Yes, and
I want to hear you.
Well, I think you mentioned Christianity, and I think a major difference though between Christianity and Judaism is also that Christianity believes in an afterlife, and Jews don't, and so that, you know, the far left, the totalitarians, the communists, they're obviously very oppressive towards Christians. They banned Christianity. They, you know, killed priests and nuns and whatnot. But at least with Christians, their perfect world exists after the here and now. And so that, you know, for the Jews who believe in tikkun olam and making this world a better place, that makes the Jews, I would say, a more immediate problem and a more immediate threat. But yes, I think this is certainly true that rejecting the perfectibility of mankind, rejecting the kind of grand designs of central planners is profoundly obnoxious to them. And I can just think of, from my personal experience, you know, I lived in Germany when there was a debate over banning circumcision. And you've lived in Germany and you know Germany quite well. And, you know, the Germans have a very, they're very rational, pragmatic people. And if you just look at, you know, circumcision from this rational, pragmatic view, then it's barbarism, right? It is child mutilation. And that was how they approached this issue in the public debate. And there was no appreciation for tradition. There was no appreciation for, you know, the millennia of practice. I think this is the topic of your third issue of continuity. It just didn't make sense to them. You know, fortunately, Angela Merkel and her, you know, basically intervened and stopped this from happening. But I think that's sort of an example of an issue, which is not necessarily a left-wing issue. You had a lot of right-wingers who were in favor of banning circumcision as well. But it does show how these practices. And there are other ways in which this is happening in Europe in terms of kosher slaughter. They're trying to ban kosher slaughter in certain countries too, where you take this sort of, you know, purely rational, pragmatic viewpoint that has no respect for religious sentiment, for things that are sort of ineffable, perhaps, and where it collides with Jewish practice and Jewish tradition.
Let me challenge you or push you, I guess, a little bit, which is, if you sort of take a, if you look at international politics writ large, you will also find that ethnic minorities in any society that outperform the majority society, especially economically, have been the subject of vehement and often violent oppression. The Chinese in Indonesia, South Asians in Uganda in the 1960s and 1970s, and of course, much more familiar to those of us, you know, closer to the European experience, Jews in Europe and to the United and the United States. And the Jews have always been one of those minorities that has outperformed, particularly in professions requiring literacy, numeracy, fine-grained academic or intellectual skills. I guess what I'm saying is that there's an envy issue here. And envy has always been a kind of current, an emotion that has run through a politics on the left that believes in radical equality, equality of outcome, and redistribution of wealth. Mm. So, you know, you paid special attention to this horrible cartoon, right? Of the Mir One artist. I'm going to see if I can. People will be familiar with this infamous. It's not a cartoon. It was a wall mural that was put up by an American muralist, went by the nickname of Mir One, that Jeremy Corbyn famously defended back in 2012 or 2013 or so, because it was playing on these tropes of the greedy Jew, you know, who controls all of the world's money. And this is one of these funny cases where when the artist was confronted with his own anti-Semitism, he said something like, well, it's just old Jews who are, you know, excessively attached to those Rothschild and Warburg, you know, dynasties. Mm. So that's also, it seems to me, one aspect here. I'd love for you to reflect on this and the extent to which this also inflects the left's view of Israel and of Jews in their own societies.
So envy, is that as a motivator, as a motivation? Yes, and I think we need to be more forthright that this new word and this new term, equity, which is not equality, I think Jews in particular need to be very outspoken about this, because basically what equity means is that there needs to be, and you know, we're going to quote Dr. Imran X. Kendi himself, who says that, you know, there will not be equity unless we have an exact similarity between the proportion of a certain group's percentage of the population and their representation in certain fields, right? So unless you know, the incoming class at Harvard is exactly representative of what the racial makeup of the United States is, then there won't be equity. Interestingly, there was a story in the Wall Street Journal, which is showing there's a huge gap between women and men in higher ed, where it might be almost 60-40 within the next couple of years, women to men. So if we're trying to smash the patriarchy, I think we're doing a pretty good job of that. But as Jews, we have to be very concerned about this, because this is basically calling for a quota system.
Which is precisely what Jews were able to smash back in the
19... Right. So according to Dr. Kendi, and I'm surprised he's never been asked this, probably because he refuses to engage in any sort of debate or conversation with anyone who would ask him a challenging question. But, you know, are you aware that your policies would call for a 2% ceiling on the number of Jews allowed in higher ed? I mean, this is just patently absurd. I mean, are we going to put a 5% cap on the number of homosexuals in Broadway theater? I mean, this is, you know, it's just a bizarre notion that has now taken over, again, all of our liberal institutions.
What, you see, what should be the gay cap in Broadway?
Again, I believe in everyone's abilities, bringing them as far as they can, and I thought that was the American principle, the American creed. So yes, this even though this you know, wokeness is not, I would say, it's not motivated by anti-Semitism. It's not like, you know, Dr. Kendi is waking up every morning with, you know, full of a hatred of Jews, right? Or even most of these people who we would identify as kind of the tribunes of this woke movement. It's not necessarily anti-Semitic in intent, if I could borrow a phrase from the former president of Harvard, Lawrence Summers. It's not anti-Semitic in intent. It is absolutely anti-Semitic in effect. And not only
in the... Why are you so sure that it's not anti-Semitic in intent?
Well, I think there are some individuals... Because I don't want to paint with a broad brush. I think when we talk about wokeness, there's different schools of thought, there's different personalities. There are just, you know, average everyday people, I think, who are maybe signing up to certain movements with good intentions. There are people who have bad intentions, absolutely. So I'm trying not to generalize. I think for most of the people, say, who are being kind of led into this belief system, the kind of DEI, right, diversity, equity, and inclusion, I think most of them are probably going into it with benign intent or benign motives. But the impact and the effect of it, I think, is undeniably anti-Semitic. And not just because of the quota system I talked about. I think its way of thinking and the way it's producing anti-Semitic thoughts. And there was a question I think someone here posted. This also goes back to, and as an example of this, if you look back in May during these during the fighting between Hamas and Gaza, a lot of people, a lot of friends of mine who aren't necessarily political, they were just noticing a lot of Facebook posts or social media posts from other friends of theirs who are not political people that they found to be anti-Semitic. And I think this is a direct consequence of sort of this, you know, great awakening that the country has been in for the last 14 or 15 months since the murder of George Floyd. And I think we can draw a direct line from kind of the ways of thinking that became more popular, the habits of mind, the obsession with putting people into groups and looking at individuals and judging arguments, not by their validity, but by the people who make them, right? So you can't possibly make that argument because you are not a X, Y, or Z, right? Or that argument is invalid because you are a male, you know, person who comes from this community and you're that, right? This mode of thinking, I think, is very dangerous for Jews.
Yeah.
And I think, I'll just end at that. But.
Well, exactly. And so I guess before we turn to questions, let's turn to prescription. We are confronting an environment in institutions that where Jews had previously felt more than welcome. If anything, they had felt like they were integral to, you know, the life of academia, the life of media, the life of museums, cultural institutions. Suddenly being pushed not only to one side, but being forced either to kind of adopt an attitude of contrition, or otherwise being asked sort of to leave, not explicitly, but that's the kind of sense. So what is the Jewish academic? What is the Jewish journalist? What is the, you know, what is the response? How do we organize individually and communally to call attention to what this is and stop it?
So I think a lot of this has to do with the relationship between Blacks and Jews, frankly. I think a lot of what we're getting at and a lot of what the issue of this magazine deals with is the fraught relationship between Blacks and Jews. And I think it's important for Jews to understand that American Jews, that, you know, our experience of America and our understanding of what America is and its promise is very different from that of African Americans. I mean, African Americans were brought here as slaves, and they were enslaved for hundreds of years, and they were discriminated against legally for 100 years after that. And there are still obviously the effects of that discrimination that we see to this day. For American Jews, this country is the golden Medina. I mean, it is the greatest thing. Next to the creation of the State of Israel in the 20th century. And Jews have prospered in America better than probably any other ethnic group, I think it's fair to say. And so I think Jews romanticize America, and we are perhaps more hesitant to see its faults because of that experience. Whereas if you're Black, it's really hard to ignore those faults. And so I think a lot of the miscommunication or the conflict that has arisen over the past couple of years, really, with this kind of this rise of this woke movement, which is really driven in large part, I think, by a reckoning over America's racial history, which, by the way, Jews can be proud of our role in that history. And it's sad that that is not acknowledged, I think. And I think a lot of the bitterness from the American Jewish community comes from the fact that, you know, you look at the number, you look at the proportion of freedom riders, right, who are Jews. You look at the lawyers who worked for the NAACP. I mean, I could go on and on and on. The Jewish contribution to the civil rights movement is legendary. And it seems that, you know, Jews are not really respected or are not acknowledged for that. But I do think that that is what I think makes the kind of Jewish-Black relationship both exciting and interesting and fascinating. And there's a lot of potential in it. And there's been great achievements in that relationship, but it also makes it challenging and hard, is that you have one community that has been oppressed like none other in this country. And then you have the other community, which is also a minority community, which has succeeded like none other, and that loves America despite its faults, warts and all, right? And so I think that drives a lot of this in terms of these liberal institutions, because you have a lot of Jews in these liberal institutions, and you have this racial reckoning, and it's confusing for a lot of Jews. And I think we feel rightly that we're being unfairly kind of grouped in with this kind of white oppressor structure, which is unfair. You know, how to resolve this other than kind of speaking honestly in the way that I just have, I'm not sure. But that's my, yeah.
Well, let's go to questions. I would just make one point, which is, you know, one of the sort of fancy terms from academia is this particular use of the word interrogate. Mm. Our academics constantly urge people to interrogate power, interrogate ideas,
texts,
interrogate language, interrogate texts. Fine. We should interrogate this word privilege.
Mm.
Because the word privilege has assumed a kind of hallowed status, I think, in the lexicon of the new left, kind of an all-purpose, a catch-all for everything that's wrong in society. There is privilege in society, and it has to be questioned, if not brought down. And that has to be interrogated, because it assumes that all privilege is, in a sense, unearned, right? It assumes that all privilege, the moment it becomes privileged, should be not just ruthlessly challenged, but torn down. It assumes that privilege is synonymous with power, and not just power, but institutional, structural, permanent power. And I find that idea particularly troubling. If you looked at the Jewish community in Germany in 1927, it was a very privileged community. But its privilege, its particularly its economic privilege, but to some extent its political privilege, never translated into the power that it needed to stave off the greatest catastrophe in Jewish history. And people who, quote, enjoy economic, quote unquote, privilege today can be deprived of it very swiftly, especially in democratic societies that don't necessarily respect what went into earning that privilege. So that is, I think, a point of attack or at least a point of argument that has to be stressed in all these conversations. I've taken up too much time, so I wanna ask some of the questions that our audience is asking. And let's keep the answers short just so that we can get through as many as we can. We have Trisha Roth saying, any thoughts about the failure of the Jewish community and Jewish organizations to confront the anti-Semitism we see, a triple threat, mostly on the left, from Islamism and somewhat still from the right. I don't even see the ADL yet adequately dealing with this reality. Are any organizations dealing with it aside from scholars who study contemporary anti-Semitism? The little I hear from the Jewish community, adds Tricia Roth, is the tired, we need to dialogue approach.
Yeah, I mean, I think the I'm not gonna name specific organizations, but I do think that these organizations are not up to the task. The legacy ones, that the old sort of model of, you know, sort of Jewish communal political activism may be obsolete. I mean, if you just look at the Iran deal and how that was able to go through without, for all the vaunted power of the Jews, right, in the Israel lobby, look at how that policy was enacted. But I do think our kind of legacy Jewish institutions are not really fit to purpose. And it's hard to see that they are accomplishing their jobs. If you just look at the annual rate, you know, the annual polling that they do on anti-Semitic attitudes and whatnot, anti-Semitic attacks, clearly the situation is not getting better. And so I think that Jewish institutions need to rethink their approach to these issues. And that's clearly what this conversation and this, you know, this initiative that the Maimonides Fund has undertaken is geared towards doing. But I think it's very difficult for Jews of a certain generation who kind of grew up thinking that, yes, the major problems are coming from the far right and it's neo-Nazis and whatnot. You know, that's not the case anymore. And I think it's very difficult to accept that, you know, like these universities that I've given a lot of money to every year that I graduated from, that I really want my kids to get into, like maybe they're the problem. Like maybe they are the problem. Like maybe higher education in this country is contributing more harm than good as a Jew. I mean, forget all the other ways in which it's contributing harm. That's just a really difficult thing for Jews of all people to wrap their heads around, right? The notion that higher education is a font of conflict and problem for Jews, right? Or media, right? The fact that the media, which Jews supposedly control, is now becoming
if only
we control the media, right? So I think it's again to all these institutions that we kind of grew up believing in, the ACLU, right? The ACLU is like, you think of like the archetypical ACLU lawyer, it's like a Jewish guy defending Nazis, right? And like, that's not the ACLU anymore. I hate to tell you, I hate to break it to you. That's not, and so it's all these sorts of institutions that we grew up venerating are now corrupted. And it's very.
Let me go to another question. Yeah. An anonymous question. During the conflict in May, I, as a young person, was shocked to see my friends sharing explicitly and covertly anti-Semitic posts on social media. I had an urge to post, but I can't help but think that I might just be contributing to the conflict that social media itself thrives on. This is a very bright young person. Is social media an effective way to deal with rising anti-Semitism, or would it be wiser to engage elsewhere? Excellent question.
Well, I know, Brett, you've been off Twitter for a couple of years, and I, although I have a Twitter account, my partner has my password, so I cannot actually access it.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you, it's probably one of the greatest things that's happened to me over the past couple of years, not being on Twitter, at least not on it all the time. And I actually, so it's hard for me to answer this question, because I understand that most people who are politically active and engaged, they feel the need to be on these social media platforms. But I find them ultimately to be a waste of time, a waste of mental energy, extremely ephemeral. And you know, I've just finished writing a long book that'll be published next year. And to compare the kind of work I had to do for that and the place I had to put myself into writing it with where I was when I was on Twitter getting into arguments, it's just night and day. And it's not a person that I admire, you know, my Twitter persona. So I advise people to kind of avoid social media, actually. And I don't know if that helps answer this question, because I mean, people are on it and it's influential, I guess. But in terms
it's
of
interesting, you know, that people are on two things: they're on drugs or they're on social media, and they're the same thing.
They are the same thing.
A question from our friend Martin Crozell in Canada. First of all, he praises you for your honesty and courage. His question: how much is the decline in the quality of the teaching in history and civics in the public schools responsible for the rise of anti-Semitism and the inability to respond to it?
That's a good question. I can't claim to be an expert on, you know, civics education and the state of it in this country. But you see these polls that show, you know, depressingly low numbers of young Americans, you know what the Holocaust was or know how many Jews died. I mean, basic questions about really one of the most pivotal events in the history of not just the 20th century, but I would argue mankind. And it's incredibly dispiriting. There are other scholars who say that Holocaust education itself has become a problem, in that it doesn't, and that it almost has the opposite of its intended effect, right? That you make people resentful of Jews in the way that the Holocaust is taught in schools. So it's a tricky question. All I can say is that I think if civics education were done properly in high schools, then we wouldn't have a lot of these problems. I think it would inoculate the future generation from a lot of the bad ideas that seem to be current. If people understood what the Constitution was, if they understood what, you know, pluralism was, if they understood the history of the United States, not the Howard Zinn history of the United States, if they were given a full and proper, you know, understanding of the history of the United States, that was not just one long tale of, you know, woe and slavery and oppression and homophobia and, you know, the oppression of women and whatnot, but an honest accounting of American history, its good parts and its bad parts, that I think that our younger generation wouldn't be so susceptible to the ideas that they are now spouting.
Let me ask you a question. My dog is barking in the back there. It must be because we're surrounded by Jews. That was a joke. Miriam Bowden, an important part of this dilemma is that Jews themselves are perpetuating this wokeness. They buy into the DEI concepts and are complicit in the worst of the movements. Very good point from Miriam Bowden. Comment?
Yeah, I mean, this isn't new, right? There's always been the self-hating Jew or the Jew who thinks that they can earn themselves protection from the anti-Semites, from the king, from the pharaoh, from the commissar, by basically ratting out his fellow Jews. And this has been kind of a recurring theme in Jewish life. And in fact, it's hard for me to think of any other people. You know, you hear like the term Uncle Tom, right? Or there are kind of the closeted gay people who are homophobic. I mean, these people exist in all different types of minority communities, obviously. I can't think of another community where there are more, or certainly more visible examples of this phenomenon than Jews. I mean, what other group has, you know, the Noam Chomskys, the Norman Finkelsteins? I mean, there's so many of these people.
And there's also something more to it, I would add, because, you know, when you have members of minority groups that are flatly in opposition to the consensus view of a given minority group, when it comes to Jews, they are celebrated by the culture at large.
Right.
When it comes to other minorities, they are scorned by the culture at large. Now, you might make the argument that we should always celebrate those gadfly voices, whether they are Black, gay, Jewish, or otherwise. But again, this seems to me to be of a piece with this kind of consistent double standard,
yes,
where the one Jew you want to hear about on the subject of Israel is the Jew who denounces Israel, whereas the last gay person, you know, you would want, or is someone who is standing apart from what has become a consensus.
No, I mean, you look at someone like Clarence Thomas, right? Like, it's wrong to say that Black people get what they get in life because of their skin color, or that they benefit from affirmative action only because of their skin color, except when it comes to Clarence Thomas, right? It's wrong to say that, you know, Black people are not as smart as everyone else, except when it comes to Clarence Thomas, or pick your Black conservative thinker, you know. You're absolutely right. Jewish dissidents, on the other hand, are venerated. They're courageous. They're speaking truth to power. They are fighting the Jewish establishment. Yes, and I can't think of any other community for whom the kind of mainstream media or institutions whose prodigal sons, you might say, are venerated and celebrated other than those who dissent from kind of the Jewish mainstream. Yeah.
I want to be respectful of people's time, and we said this would last an hour. Jamie, I think many of us could listen to you for a very long time. I urge those of you who are in the audience who have not read Jamie's piece, it is, as with everything Jamie writes, just absolutely brilliantly written, and infused with a kind of intellectual energy, which I think just has distinguished you over the many years that I've known you. The magazine or the journal is Sapir, Jamie's essay on our duty to be unimpressed is in our first issue on social justice. Look for it on our website at sapirjournal.org. Mentioned that this is a journal of Jewish conversation. I meant that seriously. We want to continue to expand this conversation. We want to invite different voices, contradictory voices, because we think these are conversations that absolutely have to be had, and that we learn things about ourselves as Americans or as individuals and as Jews when we speak like this about the things that really matter in the most candid and lucid way possible. And I think as everyone who's listening in can see how much Jamie has contributed to that. So thank you. Thanks again to the Maimonides Fund for sponsoring this venture. We will be doing more of these. Our issue on continuity will be coming out next month. And then a few months later, our issue on aspiration. Please continue to participate, and see you next time. And Jamie, take good care of yourself.
Thank you.
See you soon.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again. Bye-bye.
All right.